Artist Wendell Castle revolutionized the art world with a simple idea. Here he is explaining it to KCUR's Laura Spencer in 2011.
I thought that furniture, and very special furniture done in a very special way, ought to be accepted, displayed, collected, and bring the kind of money that sculpture did.
Wendell Castle was known as the father of the studio furniture movement of the 1960s and 70s. He built chairs mostly that looked like sculptures. They're in the world's most famous museums, and he kept on making them right up until the end. Wendell Castle died earlier this year at 85, and right now the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art has an entire exhibition dedicated to his work. He was from Kansas.
I mean, I grew up in a rural community, Holton, Kansas. I never studied cabinet making or furniture design or any of those things. The only shop class I ever had in my life was seventh grade shop in Coffeyville, Kansas.
One shop class and not a single course in furniture design. But still, as his New York Times obituary put it, he coaxed wood and other materials into weird, mind-bending shapes, like giant teeth or tongues or elephant's feet that you could sit on. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're listening back to a conversation about Wendell Castle's life and his unconventional path to the top of the art world on KCUR's Central Standard. We're joined by a whole panel this morning, but I want to start with Glenn Adamson. He's a curator, writer, and historian based in Brooklyn, and he worked closely with Wendell Castle. Hi, Glenn.
Hi there, Gina.
What would you tell someone who's never seen Wendell Castle's work, who's never heard of this guy before, about what he did and why he matters?
Well, I think the best way to come to Wendell's work is to throw away everything you think you know about furniture and start from scratch. And that's really what he did. As you just heard, he did not have any traditional training as a furniture maker. He trained as a sculptor, and he developed a lot of techniques and processes that would let him make furniture in a totally unconventional way.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, maybe the best known technique from early in his career is called stack lamination. And what that means is that he took boards and stacked them up, glued them to one another, and he made a kind of rough shape in that way, and then just started carving into it with a chainsaw, angle grinders, and then finally chisels. And using that technique, he could make absolutely any form that he wanted, very different from traditional joined furniture. So that furniture, in fact, looks more like a sculpture by Henry Moore, let's say, than it does like anything you would have seen in a usual living room.
You've called him the most important post-war furniture designer.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
Explain.
So what makes him important for American post-war design is that he really has this imagination that is unbridled, and he carries on with one innovation after another over a course of, well, more than 50 years, sometimes returning to some of his older ideas, sometimes paving totally new ground. And that's really something you don't see from anybody else in the field of furniture. It's just the uniqueness and individuality and ultimately the intensity of his imagination that I'd like to respect and recall now that he's passed.
Well, we will get back to that. But do you remember meeting him for the first time?
Oh, yes. He's unforgettable.
To us about that, how he came across that first meeting.
Well, you know, one thing, it's funny, he just mentioned in that clip you played that he took classes from Coffeyville. In Coffeyville, he learned a little bit of shop there. And actually, my grandfather was from Coffeyville, Kansas. And so that whole Midwestern personality, it was very strong in him. He had an incredible work ethic and incredible plain-spokenness. But also, he was extremely elegant. So he wore beautiful tailored suits and immaculate wingtip shoes. He drove a Bentley car late in his life. So he had this wonderful combination of being, on the one hand, totally pragmatic, something I think he got from his Kansas roots, and also very, very cosmopolitan. You know, he would go to Italy, he would go all over Europe. And there was a lot that sort of seemed to coalesce in this man between the local and the global.
I have encountered him. I wouldn't say I met him. We didn't speak or anything, but I saw him, and he visually, it's not just his clothes. I mean, he had this curly chin-length gray hair and these very whimsical round glasses.
Yeah, he had these candy color glasses. The frames sort of glinted around his eyes, and his eyes were pretty shiny to begin with. So he just had an incredible presence to him, didn't he?
Yeah, I've read someone describing him as like that he seemed like a genius who didn't realize what the fuss was all about.
That's a great thing to say. Yes, he had a modesty to him that really belied his achievements. And I think he knew on some level that he had really reinvented furniture as we know it. But on the other hand, he was mainly interested in the next thing he was going to make. And, you know, this is a guy that really spent every day of his life that he could in the studio, you know, not just 6 days a week, but 7 days a week. He would be in there drawing, carving models, then getting out the chainsaw and actually working into the wood. He had a large team of people he worked with who, you know, depended on him for their livelihoods, and he really looked after them beautifully and really made an amazing studio to visit as well. So this is a guy that was really always turning his mind to the next thing, not just looking back at his achievements.
There's a story he used to tell about his time at KU where he studied industrial design and sculpture. And I guess he didn't have a toolbox. So one of the first things he did in a sculpture class was build himself a toolbox. And the teacher was sort of miffed that he was spending valuable studio time that way. And he thought, well, why isn't this toolbox art if I made it in this class?
And yeah, that's right. That's right. He said, well, I'll show you. I can make a toolbox into art. And, you know, then there will be no contradiction. And that's what he went on to do.
I mean, what does that say to you, not just about him, but also about the way he interacted with the art world?
Well, he was a man who liked a challenge. He liked to challenge himself. And I think that was partly, again, the work ethic, but it was also just seeing what would happen if he pushed himself. He had this very, you know, funny, wise set of rules that he liked to follow, that he published. There were 10 of them. And my favorite has always been, if you hit the target every time, then the target's too close to you. So he had this idea that you always have to reach further, try to get somewhere where you've never been before.
Well, before we dive too deep into that, just a little bit of his personal story. I'm going to turn to one of our local guests in a moment, but one of the first things you write about him in the remembrance that you've written, it's really lovely, is that he struggled with dyslexia growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. It's quite moving. And this is something I know because he gave a talk actually to a group of students and other furniture makers. So he was very open about it. And he said basically that when he was growing up, you know, as a child and then as a teenager, he felt like he wasn't good at anything. And people basically, horrible to say, but people thought he was stupid because he had such severe dyslexia that he just couldn't cope with the schoolwork. And now, of course, we know much better understood today than it was then that a lot of artistic people have dyslexia, and it seems to all be kind of hooked up or wired in that way.
And that it's not a measure of intelligence, of course.
Exactly. And certainly, you wouldn't ever say that Wendell Castle was anything but incredibly intelligent, both as an artist and as a, you know, as a businessman, you know, leading his own studio, and also as somebody who thought deeply about what he was doing intellectually. So he was able to get through that really by discovering art. And so it was, I think, in some ways, from his perspective, a little bit of a miracle that he was able to rise above that beginning that he had had and the frustration. And I think also the struggles with self-confidence that he had. And, you know, maybe in terms of what it meant for him later in life, it meant that he never took it for granted, you know, that he had to really fight for what he had. And he was proud. But then, of course, he always had that underlying modesty as well.
Well, I want to bring in Susan Earle now. She's the curator of European and American art at the Spencer Museum in Lawrence. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Gina.
What else can you tell us about Wendell Castle's upbringing here in Kansas?
Well, I appreciate everything Glenn has already mentioned. He grew up in a farm or near a farm, as we mentioned, and his grandparents were farmers. His Kansas roots were very meaningful to him, and I think it's part of why he came back to KU many times, including most recently just a few months ago for a Distinguished Alumni Award from the School of Architecture and Design. And then his honorary doctorate that he received in May of 2013 was so meaningful for him. He really almost kind of teared up in the interview that he did with our director, Sarah Lynn Rees-Hardy, and our photographer, Ryan Wagner, at his studio, when he was talking about how meaningful it was for him to receive an award from the University of Kansas that had meant so much.
Did he explain what it was that was so poignant for him about that?
Well, he said the other schools from which he had received honorary doctorates did not have a particular tie to him, which is kind of unusual, I guess, but that KU recognizing him felt just so important to him. It was a school that had meant so much to him. And although he felt like he did well on one level and on other levels struggled, but I think to be recognized by that university meant so much. And I think it in his home state also was really meaningful for him.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard that growing up, maybe his community didn't recognize him as like a future great anything. And I wonder what more you can tell me about that. I mean, it does seem like it would be especially poignant for someone who grew up that way to get that level of recognition from the flagship university in their state. But yeah, take me back a little bit more to, yeah, just his family, his community.
So I haven't met his family members, but it sounds like he had a fairly typical kind of rural and isolated life. They lived outside of Emporia. Emporia is a wonderful community, and I don't know how well known he was within the community. He does seem like he was pretty shy growing up, and even as Glenn mentioned, as an adult, he was very unassuming. He had this incredible combination of presence and style, very notable style that really would rivet people when they saw him, but very unassuming. And I think that's part of perhaps what he learned growing up in a humble environment. And so, you know, would his peers have recognized anything about him? Probably not. I mean, that's part of what makes him so fascinating, is that he could come from a modest background in which he may have had, you know, few friends or little recognition as a child, and yet he totally flourished once he found his voice and his mediums, which he, you know, bent to such a degree that, you know, it's completely changed the way we think about both furniture and sculpture.
When he came to KU, as he told us earlier in the show, in that recording with Laura Spencer, he didn't study furniture design. He studied industrial design.
Yes, and that is still what one would study if you came to KU and wanted to study furniture. The category would be industrial design, which is really interesting. And they, you know, he said that some of his professors didn't want him to go in the kind of furniture direction. But what's amazing is that it sounds like industrial design was sort of a compromise with his family of how to let him not quite study art, but do something that would theoretically be more practical. But he took all the practicality that he learned from that. And we, you know, to this day have some real artists who teach in that area. So his bending of those categories continues to be an influence at University of Kansas and many other places. So, but he learned some of the techniques that, you know, involved that led to product design, so that part of his later output was informed by all of that background. It's just amazing how he took that training and then the sculpture training and didn't really hew that closely to either one in a traditional way, but made them into something extraordinary.
So talk to me about his early career. How did he go from being this guy who's sort of challenging his professors a little bit at KU to being someone who's collected in museums worldwide and who is known really as the father of an art movement?
So he really just seemed to charge out on his own. I think having had such strong roots in Kansas and then attending university in his home state, I think then gave him the wings to really fly. And he headed straight to New York City after he graduated with his master's in sculpture. And before that, I think he had already submitted a work to an exhibition at the Nelson Atkins Museum as a sculpture. And so he really had an amazing amount of confidence given his modesty and his admission of his struggles, but he charged on ahead. So he showed a work at the Nelson Atkins very early, went to New York City.
What was it?
It was his, I think, a chair, but he exhibited it as a sculpture. So that was sort of an important small milestone for him.
And that was unusual at that time, that a chair would be a sculpture. Because now you do see that. I mean, that's in a modern art wing of a museum. You see that.
Right. But you wouldn't have seen it then. You wouldn't have seen it in 1960. It just would not have happened. So that he went to the studio, when he went on a road trip with a friend, that he, you know, knocked on the door of Alexander Calder, that he felt confident enough to just show up at the home of a famous kinetic sculpture artist, and that Calder welcomed him in. You know, he clearly had this kind of ambition combined with this modesty that really made it so that some doors opened and others closed, but he just kept charging ahead. And I think being in New York then was a help for him.
Describe some of your favorite works by Wendell Castle. I'm guessing that some of those are at the Spencer Museum.
Yes, they are. He has many other wonderful works, but in 2003, I approached him about acquiring one of his sculptures. He had started a new series that, you know, turned even more things on their heads from what he had done. We acquired a work that I proposed called Hanging in the Balance. And it's a chair that would be completely non-functional because there's no seat. It's just the outlines of a chair made of bronze, and it's turned upside down onto what looks like a pillow. And many people are convinced it's an actual soft pillow. They want to put their head down on it, but it's made out of wood. So he used this trompe l'oeil, or fooling the eye, that he had loved his whole career. And he started a new way of using it where he combined the hard and the soft, but both of them are still made out of these hard materials. So that work is a real star in our collection. It's become one of our signature works. People make pilgrimages to see it. Then he gave us recently, when he got the honorary doctorate, this amazing chair called Nirvana in 2013. And it's from an edition. There are others, but he repainted our chair from a more purplish to a more bluish color to reflect his devotion to the University of Kansas and to mimic the kind of Jayhawk blue.
You know, I want to bring Glenn back in on this too. I'd like for the both of you to talk about the importance of craft in his work. In that interview he did with Laura Spencer in 2011, he said that of all the tools he uses, and we've already heard that he uses a chainsaw, but that his pencil is the most important.
So some artists use pencil in drawings and some don't. Wendell Castle always did, as far as I know. And he described that he would put the pencil on the paper and not know where it was going. It's kind of like, you know, writing in a journal and just keeping your pencil down and you don't know what's going to unfold. So that I think it was a way for ideas and forms to form on paper for him. And he used that then to create his sculptures.
You know, he started off his career making furniture furniture/sculpture that emphasized originality. It emphasized using all of the sophisticated visual language that artists bring to sculpture. And then he shifted to a period where he decided to try something new, recreating old furniture forms, but then doing something kind of funny to them. And when you talk about Hanging in the Balance, like the pillow, it's sort of like this sense of humor. And that was known as this trompe l'oeil period. When Laura interviewed him in 2011, she asked him how his work had evolved, and he told her that later in life he came back full circle to that early idea of starting from scratch with nothing but his own vision. Here's what he said.
That was actually quite successful in the art world, but it wasn't fulfilling to me in the end because I didn't get to sit at the drawing table the way I am at this moment, trying to discover new things and new ideas, and I don't ever want to be that person that just makes the same thing over and over again because somebody will buy it. I want to discover new things and take risks.
You know, Glenn, you were talking earlier about his incredible imagination and his unusual push toward always doing something new. What do you hear?
I think in terms of his recent work particularly, one thing that is absolutely astonishing to me is the way that he was able to take on robotics at the end of his career. This was maybe a surprising move, but he actually went out and bought a robot carving arm that he got from the post office, if you can believe that. So the device had recently been used to sort of pick and place packages in a post office sorting center, and he repurposed it in order to be able to carve wood with it, and then use that device as a way of creating these monumental furniture forms over the past 10 years or so.
Man, I mean, robotics, taking on robotics, at what age?
Well, he started a little bit before he was 80, but he really figured it out over the last, 5 years. So I'd say between the age of 80 and 85. So we're talking about an octogenarian here.
We're going to take a short break. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll pick right back up with the story of Wendell Castle, a Kansas native who died earlier this year. He made furniture that looks like art, or art that looks like furniture. He has an exhibit right now at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're listening back to a conversation with Spencer Museum curator Susan Earle and Brooklyn-based writer and curator Glenn Adamson. I spoke with them right after Wendell Castle died earlier this year. He was an art world giant. He had a distinctive look, curly gray hair down past his chin, and whimsical round glasses, and he stayed close to his Kansas roots, even though he went on to change the art world in a big way by making furniture that was art in the 1960s. They just opened an exhibit at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art featuring his life's work. Mo Dickens is here with us too, and I want to bring him in now. Mo is the curator at the Belger Art Center, and he organized an exhibit that brought Wendell Castle to Kansas City in 2011. Hi, Mo.
Hello.
You knew Wendell's art before you met him. What struck you about the work itself?
Well, in the Belger collection, we have a giant desk. It's a three-tiered desk that folds up, and there's chairs made to go with it. And it's a well-made object. And we have a giant lamp. It's unlike any lamp you've ever seen. And
Okay. So this desk, I'm also guessing, is unlike any desk I've ever seen?
Yeah. In fact, the catalog resume that was being put together recently asked me to send them a picture. And I sent them a picture of this desk, and they went, oh, we didn't know you had so much of his work. And I went, that's one piece.
Well, so describe it. Describe these pieces.
It's about the size of the desk we're sitting at here, which for viewers at home, it's about the size of a room. But it's on pivots. There's three sections of various heights, and they come out into the space, but you're able to fold them up. And there's this huge, it's a stacked lamination piece. Glenn Adamson mentioned that Wendell perfected that way of working. So it looks like one solid piece of wood that's almost like carving into a rock, only it's wood. And the signature, I love showing people the signature at the base of this pedestal holding up one section of the table. It just says WC76. If you've seen his work these days, he signs it Castle 2010 or did Castle 2011. Very elegant script. But in those days, it looked like a R. Crumb signature, just a WC76, kind of like a hippie signature on a desk, like a hippie desk, but a very valuable, well-made. So, when I started working at the Belger, I wasn't that familiar with him, but we do a lot of art shows, but we had this furniture sitting around, and I came to tell my visitors, I said, I guess what Mr. Belger collects is the well-made object. He doesn't really worry about whether you call it furniture or art or sculpture. And Susan alluded to his education at KU, and he got his MFA in sculpture. I found an old interview he did with Smithsonian one time, and it came from a small town in Kansas. So the interviewer said, what did your parents think about you studying art? And he said, oh, they had no problem with me studying art. They just had a problem with me going to KU. And the interviewer said, what? And he said, yeah, my parents were K-State fans. Which I'm sure meant nothing to the Smithsonian people, but I got a kick out of that.
Yeah, and so just quickly, the lamp, tell me about this lamp.
Oh, it's about 4 feet tall, and it sits on a green block, and the green block is the size of an old television set, and then it has these giant curving legs that come off of it. So most people do not recognize it as a lamp. It's a functioning lamp, but it looks more like a monster coming down the hallway at, on the second floor at a Belger.
So when you did finally meet him, what made you decide to bring him to town and do an exhibition of his work?
Well, actually, I have to credit Dick and Evelyn Belger for that. That was their idea. I didn't know at the time that the Nelson had never done a solo show with Wendell. And being a local hero, I assumed that had already happened. So we were able to do this. And the Nelson's working on one now. It's going to open this summer. And Stephanie K. DeLugos is working on that. And I'm sure it's going to be great. And they're going to have pieces that people can actually sit on.
That's cool.
Nobody could sit on the work we did back in 2011. It was highly polished surfaces. And you could see the frustration on my visitors. They wanted to sit in these chairs so bad. I offered to put on flannel pajamas to sit in one. And Mr. Belger still said, no way. The surfaces are too polished.
Well, so what impression did he make when you did meet him?
The coolest guy. Glenn talked about what a stylish dresser he was. And he was. But opening night, he decided to demonstrate that these rocking chairs would actually rock. And they were huge pieces. They're more like playground equipment.
Huge. How big?
They're roughly three times the size of a regular rocking chair, but elongated, not height-wise. So he kicked off his elegant shoes, and he had on these rainbow-striped socks, and he put the socks on the runner of the rocking chair, and he just started rocking like a little kid, and that thing was flying. And he looked so happy. He could have passed for 55 or 60 years old, but he was approaching 80 at the time. And I said, Wendell, you're almost 80. Are you thinking about retiring? And he looked around the gallery at all that new work, and he said, and do what? What's more fun than this?
Yeah, I mean, rocking in a giant rocking chair does sound fun.
That you made.
Yeah. Susan, jump in here, because he did, as you mentioned, come back to KU a lot and interacted with students there. I mean, we just heard Mo's description of his playfulness. Can you tell us any more about just how he interacted with KU students?
Well, I think he just continued to inspire them every time he was there. And I think he shared a lot from his own experience. And they learned from his style. They learned from his methods, his rules that were so interesting. And
tell me more about
rules.
The rules. Glenn mentioned them earlier, but I'd like to know more about Wendell Castle's rules. It's rules for art making or for life?
Well, they're more rules for life, and I haven't memorized them, but they're very, they're funny, they're witty, they're pithy, and they're things like expect the unexpected, but they're more unexpected than that, so that he would say something, and then it goes in the other kind of direction. So I think what he's done for so many students there is his ideas were very freeing, because he really didn't, although he drew in preparation for sculpture, which some think people would call traditional, you know, he didn't just thrash around in any way. He did preparation. But I think he was very liberating for students there. And one of the projects that we did, I was so fortunate to work with some of our students and curate an exhibition of his work called Wendell Castle, About Time. And he showed in that exhibition, and the students loved this, an installation kind of work. It was a huge form, a metal, polished metal form that was probably 12 feet long, and it rotated around in a circle to tell time. And it was a way for us to think. Nobody now thinks about the millennium having turned in 2000, but at the time it loomed large in everyone's mind. Were our computers going to shut down? What was going to happen? And we thought that Wendell Castle was the perfect person to think about time with. So he created these pieces that addressed time in completely unconventional ways.
Glenn, I mean, just thinking about this person and his overarching legacy, what do you hope that people take from the story of his life, or from the way he worked, or the way he related to his craft, to the art world, to expectations?
Yeah, it's a great question. I guess, you know, for me, it's really the lesson of going out there and defining your own adventure. He did start from, you know, fairly humble roots, and he then went on to this incredible career, really, on the basis of nothing but his own imagination. So I think the reason he was inspiring to so many students was that he was like this, you know, human permission slip, you know, just go and do whatever you think would be most interesting. I was thinking back to those rules again, the 10 adopted rules of thumb, as he called them. And another one of them was a dog that stays on the porch gathers no bones, which sounds like Kansas wisdom to me. But, you know, I think that's the kind of, that's the kind of feeling you had being around him. It wasn't just what he was doing and what he was accomplishing, but also the sense that he gave you that you could maybe accomplish something that nobody had ever dreamt of too.
You know, we haven't fully touched on this, but I mean, he was doing something really groundbreaking at the time. And at this point, you know, he has imitators and there's a whole, like I said, you do see furniture in museums now. I mean, can you talk about, was that a difficult sell for him, or did people embrace him pretty easily? I mean, he's done this innovative thing, and he made a big name for himself doing it. It seems like that doesn't usually happen quickly or easily.
That's right. You know, he really invented a genre, certainly here in America. And even in other countries, you know, Italy, for example, is famous for its great designers. And Wendell was very inspired by Italian design, particularly when he did his very innovative plastic furniture in the 60s. But he really, you know, broke through that glass ceiling that the medium of furniture or craft more generally had always kind of lurked underneath, and showed that you could be as sculpturally inventive, as formally creative in a functional form as you could in a non-functional form. And he had his struggles with that. I think a lot of people wanted to categorize him in some kind of, you know, side pocket of the art world. But in a way, he was even more ahead of his time than maybe he realized, because now in the 21st century, we're realizing that these categories of art or craft or design or furniture or sculpture, you know, what's more interesting is maybe to move from one to the other in this totally fluid manner. And he was already doing that way back in the 60s. And frankly, the rest of the art world is just catching up to him in that respect.
Glenn Adamson, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And Susan Earle, Mo Dickens, thank you both as well.
Thank you, Gina.
Thank you.
Wendell Castle died earlier this year at the age of 85. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to an encore presentation of KCUR's Central Standard. When we come back, we'll speak with a man on a mission to bring back marbles. Don't go away. Right now, the National Toy and Miniature Museum here in Kansas City seems to be on a mission to bring back the game of marbles. Yes, they've got a marble exhibit on display for a whole year, but that's not all. They're also hosting regular game nights for grown-ups and training sessions for anyone who wants to become a Mibster. That's a marble player, a master marble player. So I've never played marbles myself, but I have to admit, I find it unlikely that Kansas City is going to bring back marbles in 2018. That being said, I really, really like the idea of Kansas City bringing back marbles in 2018, and I'm going to turn to an expert to get a better idea of why. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Scott Rice McBride, whose own collection of marble artifacts is in that Toy and Miniature Museum exhibit. He's also the author of not one, but two books on marbles. Hi, Scott. Welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Hello, Gina. Thank you for having me.
So just to start us off, what is your personal history with marbles?
Well, I've been a marble collector for over 50 years, and I got into marble collecting because I was a terrible marble player. And that way I didn't have to worry about losing them because I never risked them.
Okay, so that brings me to the point that there are probably people listening out there who don't know how this game is played. So can we work on spelling that out a little bit together? Because I did a little research, and I want you to tell me if I've got this right, okay?
Okay.
You make a circle out of some yarn if you're indoors, or with a stick in the dirt if you're playing outside, and everyone brings their own marbles. You put some of the marbles inside the circle, and then everyone has one marble called a shooter. Your shooter is probably your favorite marble and your biggest one?
It is not necessarily your biggest, but it's probably your favorite. It's the one that just feels right to you.
Okay. So then what you're trying to do with the shooter is, you know, you put it in one hand outside the circle, and then you put at least one knuckle touching the ground, knuckling down.
Correct.
And then you flick it in. And you try to knock the other marbles out.
You try to knock other marbles out of the ring.
So that you can either be playing for keeps or playing for fun.
Right. For keeps meant you got to keep any marbles you knocked out of the ring. So when you knuckled down, and the game you described is called Ringer. Just one of thousands of games that can be played with marbles.
Oh, so there isn't a game of marbles. There are many games of marbles.
There are many games of marbles. Prior to national marble tournaments being formed, marble games were by neighborhood. Kids made up their own games. What you're talking about is what's called a container game, where all the marbles are in one spot. You could play a game of chase where you shot marbles down a street and followed each other trying to hit marbles on the street. So you could go a long way from home doing that. Kids would play that going to and from school. The Ringer is a playground-type game where you played in a confined area.
So this whole thing of playing for keeps, I think it's sort of shocking to modern sensibilities. Like kids today, and kids when I was growing up too, I mean, you didn't go to school with your beloved toys and maybe not come home with them, all according to fair rules of play at the playground.
Well, things have changed in the last several years about the attitude of play. You know, that you risked your favorite marbles, although you probably didn't risk your favorite shooter. That never, ever got put up for the risk.
Is that part of why you probably use the shooter as a favorite so that you wouldn't be risking it?
Correct, correct.
So then the other thing that kind of strikes me about this is that, you know, play comes with a lot of gear now. You know, you have to use either some technological device or there are just a lot of accessories and equipment and marbles. Once you have the marbles, everything else is just it's kind of makeshift. You get a piece of yarn. You make it yourself.
You make it yourself. You use your own imagination. You learned negotiation skills when you played marbles because you had to negotiate the rules with the other players, because you can't have two people and play in a game of marbles or six people playing a game of marbles and not know what the rules are. So you learn to negotiate. You also learn to remediate when there was conflicts. You know, just like any game, if I interpret the rules one way and you interpret them another, one of us is not going to agree with the decision. So you learn to mediate that way.
You know, so you personally have this huge collection of marbles and marble artifacts, and you've amassed a huge wealth of knowledge about marble tournaments from history, which that's what your books are about.
Uh-huh.
What inspired all of that collecting and that research? It could be seen as such a small part of daily life that people don't give much thought to.
And they don't really. How I got started digging deeper into marble tournaments, a few years ago I went to a marble show where marble collectors get together and buy, sell, and trade marbles. And this one was in Omaha. And while I was there, one of the people that I knew says, let's go out to Boys Town. We went out to the Boys Town Museum and we're visiting with one of the curators. And he says, we've got a drawer full of pictures back here when we had a national marble tournament. He shared them with us and actually gave us copies. And one of the things that came out of that was I decided to see if I could find the young man that won that tournament.
What year was the tournament?
1947, and it was the first VFW national tournament.
Why did you want to find him?
Curiosity. Part of my collection has always been marble medals and marble trophies. So I just thought I'd see if I could find him. After about 6 months of trying to find him, I actually did find him, got to interview him, and I was going to do a presentation to another marble collectors group about his story. He was 12 years old when he went to the national tournament, and he was from Old Hickory, Tennessee. So he and his mother went by train from Old Hickory to Omaha. He probably would have never left home if he hadn't won the marble tournament and been able to qualify to go to the national. And he told stories about what the trip was like and what it was like playing marbles. And a lot of the newspaper articles I'd been given were backed up everything he said. So he had a very good memory of how things went on. He passed away shortly before, he was almost 80 years old, and he passed away shortly before I did the presentation. And one of the things that kind of hit home was we're losing these stories. It's not an important national story. It's not something that's going to be recorded forever. And I decided to go ahead and see if I could record some more stories besides just his. And that's the basis for the big book I have.
Yeah, I mean, what do these stories mean to you? The big book you have, I mean, okay, you have two books, a slender volume about Marble King marble tournaments from 1935 to 1940, and then a meatier book, like a very meaty book, on VFW tournaments from 1947 to 1962. When you think about the significance of these tournaments, not just for their own sake, but when you do think about what they say either about America or about play, what stands out to you?
Well, things that stand out to me is these were opportunities for the kids of the time to get to go places they might normally not get to go. You know, you think about in the case of Ray Warren, who was the first champion, he had never left Old Hickory, Tennessee. He probably would not have left Old Hickory, Tennessee if it had not been for the marble tournament.
And marbles, I mean, I get the idea that they have always been fairly accessible, that it's not something that only, you know, wealthy kids could get their hands on.
That's right. And if you got to be good enough, you actually could earn marbles as part of the game. That's why you played for keeps. One family that I interviewed for the tournament actually had, between first cousins, had six state champions. They got into marble playing so that they could have slingshot ammunition. They wanted to shoot the marbles out of their slingshot, and it was easier to go to the playgrounds and win them on Saturday morning than it was to go buy them because they didn't have the money to buy marbles.
It does sound a lot like little kids were basically gambling.
Yes, it was a form of gambling because you had to risk for the reward.
Well, so that notwithstanding, I mean, some aspects of marbles are timeless, which I want to get into in a second, but you write that a lot of boys born in the 1930s had grown up in wartime without a male influence in their homes. And you say these tournaments filled that void?
Well, think of the war, the men returning from war. You know, many of the young men at the time, the boys that were playing in these tournaments, had been without a lot of male leadership. So now the VFW, with the members of the VFW and the men returning from war, were organizing these tournaments. So they were giving a positive male leadership to a lot of these boys.
Marbles, in some form or another, have been around since the beginning of play. It seems that way anyway. They've been found at archaeological sites around the world in clay and wood and stone. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, if you think about it, it's a simple toy. I mean, to make a marble, all you had to do was roll up a ball of clay or pick up a nut, like an acorn or something semi-round, and you could play games with it. And that's probably how it got started.
So are we the generation that killed a childhood tradition that transcended political boundaries, time and space for thousands and thousands of years?
I don't know that we've killed it, but we certainly have damaged it.
How did we do that?
Well, there's a couple things that go on. One, the type of play has changed. Kids have much more stimulation now, electronic stimulation, than they had back in the 50s. When I was growing up, I remember having one TV station. And if there was a storm going on, you didn't watch TV because the station disappeared on you. Kids went outside and played on their own much more than they do now. I remember my school playground was a dirt playground. So you could go out and you could draw a marble circle. Well, once it got paved over, you can't do that around schools where you've got asphalt playgrounds. You know, just not as much free time. I think kids don't have as much free time. You know, my grandchildren go out and they are organized with what they're doing, when they're doing it. There's always activities planned for them. Whereas 50 years ago, I didn't have activities planned for me. It was get out of the house and go play.
What have we lost other than maybe one particular game?
Oh, I think we've probably lost some innocence. We've lost some of the imagination that kids use to play marbles. That's why every neighborhood had a different marble game, is because the imagination, you know, whether it was throwing the marbles and trying to hit them at a long distance or drawing a square instead of a circle to play marbles in, it was just
Yeah, I'm struck by that, you know, there are games that kids all over this country and probably beyond are playing identically today because, I don't know, there are ways of getting out very specific rules and sharing secrets, and that the idea that neighborhood to neighborhood, a game would have been different and reinvented by different groups of kids, that is sort of a novel concept to me.
Well, again, it's because we didn't have that mass communications we have now. You know, when kids were growing up in the 20s, 30s, 40s, even into the 50s, you might not go to the town next to you that might be 5-6 miles away, except maybe for very specific things. Every small community had a grocery store. Every small community had a hardware store. So you didn't have to go. You know, I grew up in a small town. Today, there's no grocery store. There's no hardware store. But they were all there when I was growing up. So now if you wanted to go to a grocery store from where I grew up, you have to travel almost 20 miles. So there's more interaction now than there was back then.
So we're not going to go back to another time, but what would you say is the first step in bringing back marbles?
Well, I think it's introducing kids to it, which we're doing at the museum, letting them realize that, hey, they can unplug, that they can actually enjoy some things where they get down on the ground and play marbles. We've had the opportunity to teach a lot of kids how to play marbles. Is it going to be the lifelong end-all game that it was for a lot of these kids back in the 30s and 40s? Probably not, because once they get out of the marble ring and get home, it's the same stimulation they had before.
Author and marble enthusiast Scott McBride first visited our studios back in January. You've been listening to an encore broadcast of KCUR's Central Standard. Play It for Keeps is still on view at the Toy and Miniature Museum into January of next year, so check their calendar for game nights and MIBster training sessions if you are now convinced that we do in fact need to bring back marbles. That's it for today. You can listen back to anything you've heard on KCUR's Central Standard at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we archive all our past shows. Talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross, Suzanne Hogan, Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Melody Rowell. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.